Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to the Guild Podcast, the podcast for the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. I am your host, Christopher Mary Haltman, and today we are forgoing our normal reading of an excerpt from the story from our interviewee. And the reason why is that because we've already started our storytelling podcast called The Guild Storytellers. Several of Tim Mendy's, our guest today's, stories are on there, and we want to push you to go and listen to them there. So on Spotify, anywhere you can get your podcast, go to the search for The Guild Storytellers to hear Tim read some of his own stories and read others. As I said, our guest today is Tim Mendes. Some of you might be familiar. Those of you who listen to The Guild will notice that he is, or recognize him as, the host of The Guild After Hours, where he does interviews, kind of more of a low-key interview style, with various writers. And he's also part of our recent roundtable discussion about Zero Hour 2113. It's a little bit odd here, because if you listen to me, and this is recorded earlier in the same day as I'm recording this, I actually say that nothing is locked down where I am, although the numbers were rising. Unfortunately, we are now in a form of partial lockdown here in Sweden, where I am, because in the part of Sweden where I am, because of rising numbers, which only goes to show, please take care of yourselves and each other. Don't go out unless it's necessary. Don't go to the grocery store unless it's necessary. Wear a mask, socially distance, all those things, because it actually goes out over all of us. Rant over. Now, let's go over to our interview with Tim Mendes. I would like to take the time to welcome Tim Mendes, author, podcaster, DJ, chef, all-round busy bloke, to the Guild Podcast. Welcome. How are you doing in the age of lockdown? Well, it's part two.
Yeah, lockdown part two. Yeah, thanks for having me on, Chris. I'm good. To be honest, the lockdown doesn't really impact me that much. It does in terms of my DJing, but in terms of my... That's dead. That's just dead. So, yeah. But in terms of everything else, it doesn't really impact me that much. So.
No, and I think the idea of lockdown impacts people differently, because I mean, obviously, if I were to be locked down, which I'm not right now, I wouldn't be able to go to work, but I can still work from home. But then there are people that do work from home regularly, and they get put into lockdown, and they find it depressing. It's not like they don't go out. I mean, they don't go out anyway, but just the fact that you can't go out.
To be honest, that's kind of what's got me a little bit, because I tend to go just randomly walk places, or decide on a whim I'm gonna hop on a train today and go this place or that place, and I'm missing going to gigs and things, because I got a lot of gigs up in London and that, but that ain't happening anytime soon, you know.
No, I heard, I think, what was it, like the gigs? I mean, there are some, I mean, they've been announcing a couple of gigs, but I think they're mostly like lockdown gigs. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. It's quite strange. I saw a footage of a socially distanced nightclub the other week. Oh, it looks like there's some dystopian nightmare. You've got these like tape squares on the floor and a chair in the center of it. And you got to sit on this chair, and obviously, so it's basically like a big chessboard, and you're sitting there, and there's somebody there, and somebody next to you, somebody on the other side, and all the rest of it, and you just sort of sit there and listen to music and dance a bit. And I don't see the point. You may as well just stay at home and crack a record on.
I think it would be good for like
Maybe if you kind of did it to like some kind of like BDSM sex club where people just had their own cage they could sit in and dance.
Yeah, that would work. That would work. Yeah. If you did it like some fetish night. Yeah.
You'd have somebody hanging from a ceiling from like chains in their nipple rings. I don't know.
Yeah, that could work. That could work. Like Hellraiser theme night.
Yes. Well, welcome to our Clive Barker night.
Yeah, Clive Barker night. Perfect. You could call it Midian, couldn't you, or something?
Well, maybe you should. I don't know. Float that idea to somebody because you could play like.
Yeah, there's a 10 o'clock curfew here at the minute.
Oh, so okay, well.
That ain't gonna work.
Because otherwise it would be perfect.
You know what goths are like.
Yeah. People would act like dress up or do the Hellraiser part and then listen to just John Carpenter.
Mm. Yeah, you could do that. To be honest, John Carpenter did some superb stuff.
Yeah, have you heard it? I mean, have you heard his, like, I think he released two like solo albums with like all new material that was like not soundtrack, and one of them was like remixes, so it was, you could at least sway to it.
No, some of that stuff is awesome. Mm-hmm.
It's on my dark, it's on my science fiction playlist, actually.
Really? Excellent.
So when I write science fiction, I'll use the same playlist. So it's got like V&V Nation, John Carpenter, Assemblage. Nice.
Awesome.
What else do I have? I have Enter Shikari, Pain.
Yep, quality. Yep.
So, gets me right in the mood.
Yeah. I tend to put on the Assemblage 20. I did when I was writing Zero Hour. I was listening to a lot of Assemblage 23 and people like that. A little bit of V&V Nation, more like Wolfsheim and, you know, all that kind of business. Yeah, great stuff.
It is. And this was fun because I think in a lot of ways you and I are very similar in our aesthetics, what we enjoy. I mean, both you and I are diehard Lovecraftians and everything that means. And we've discussed this. Off camera several times, you know.
Oh, yeah.
everything Michael Shea and all Ambrose Bierce and all of those guys we liked. And then we also have the music part, New Model Army. EDM. I don't know if you call it like V&V Nation is really EDM. I haven't really figured out what EDM is.
You mean EBM?
EBM. Electronic dance music, I was thinking. EDM.
Yeah, no, EBM actually came from, it was coined by Front 242 to describe their music. It was in an interview back in the late 80s, and they were asked to describe what they do, and they said it's electronic body music. So that's what it means.
Yeah. Well, I think it's bastardized, because I think there are people that refer to some electronic music as EDM, electronic dance music.
Yes, yeah. Which it's a very really strange one, because I don't see, especially Assemblage 23, I don't see them as EBM at all. EBM is the harsher end of it, I think. You know, your things like your Whoops Cut and, that sort of end of it.
Would you put KMFDM in that? Category?
No, they're industrial rock. They're in the same bracket as like Ministry and all that. Yeah. No, I'd put Assemblage 23 as just the continuation of synth pop. Yeah. Really. I mean, that's what I refer to them as. Because it's what it is. I mean, it's not that far removed from things that Soft Cell were doing in the 80s.
Yeah. You heard Ashbury Heights?
Yes. Yes, I love
Ashbury Heights. Kind of Victorian. Synth pop,
very kind of. Very cool, some very cool aesthetics there as well. I've got a friend who's like mad on them.
Yeah. anyway, what I was going to say is that we also have we have the music, we have the literature, and we also have wrestling is another.
Mm.
And that's like one of those things that I don't share that with a lot of people. I don't share that.
No, it's one of those things you kind of keep to yourself, isn't it?
And when I started, not when I first started writing, because I mean, I'm one of those guys, I've written since I was a kid, but didn't really try to do anything with it until my like later years, because I just didn't, you know, we're all our worst critic. And there's something in our lives that, you know, snaps us out of it. And then like, well, I'll give it a try. And I mean, mine was, I started writing wrestling fiction.
Right.
I had a website called TNA Fiction, which was all like continuation of total nonstop action storylines.
Nice. Nice.
It was, and I had like a whole website dedicated. I mean, it's still around. And some of the stories.
I'll have to read some of that because I'd probably really enjoy that.
But I've always thought that the storytelling of wrestling is very, very interesting if it is done well.
Yes, if it's not done like today, right.
Not like today.
Oh, no, not like today. It's just, no. I watch like, because I've got the WWE Network, and I watch it mainly for the old stuff. Because they've got all the old ECW and WCW and all the old when WWE was WWF and it was still good.
Yeah.
And I used to, I watch it for that. But I'll watch like the modern episodes of Raw and I'll just go, oh, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I think for a while TNA was the same, but now that it's Impact Wrestling and there's new management and some of the writers, like Jimmy Jacobs, for instance, who wrote for Chris Jericho, he did like the whole list thing. That was his invention.
Yes, that was brilliant.
And he works for TNA now. He works for Impact Wrestling now as a writer.
Right, because I lost interest around 2010, I think, basically when Raven sort of quit.
But he's been back.
Yeah, and when Raven quit, and then you had like Hulk Hogan and all these old guys, and it just sort of turned into a budget version of old WCW. It was just like, no, click, done with this.
I'll say that there were some good storylines there in the Hogan era, especially when they did the main event Mafia with Sting and Kurt Angle. That was really good, and then something happened. But we're not going to go into that. But I was just saying, like, so that my switch for writing was trying to further wrestling storylines that I thought was interesting and say, where could I go with this? Where was your switch, would you say?
Mine was basically because I'd written on and off since I was a kid, but it was mostly in the back of like work diaries and all that kind of business because I was a chef. You don't get much downtime. No. When you're a chef. So it was always stuff I used to do when I had 5 minutes. I'd write these little bits. But I got a spinal condition called transverse myelitis. And I was basically paralyzed on my right-hand side for a while. And I've made a great recovery. For a bit, it looked like I wouldn't walk again. But I've made a really good recovery. But I can't guarantee that my legs will be all right all the time, because if it flares up, I'll be off my feet for days. And also the other thing is I have these really violent spasms in my right arm. So that's not going to work if I'm chopping things. I've got a knife and I end up, because I mean, I lobbed a packet of biscuits at somebody in a shop like a couple of months back, just because I picked it up and I had a spasm and the packet just went sailing off down the aisle. Went inches past this guy's nose, and I'm like, "Oh, really? Sorry." And so it's like I can't drive anymore. Things like that, because obviously, again, the same thing. If I'm on my motorbike or even in a car, and I have one of these spasms in my leg or my arm, I could cause a major pileup or something, you know? So I was sulking because that was basically the end of my career. And I, despite moaning about it all the time, I really enjoyed it because I love cooking. I love the creative aspect of it. And I was sulking. So I did what I often do when I'm sulking. is I got out my Necronomicon, Complete Lovecraft. And as I was reading, as you do, yeah. I mean, that's what I do. If I just lose myself in it, if I'm having a bad time, you know. And I was reading Colour Out of Space, and I had this idea, and I was like, well, what have I got to lose? I may as well just give it a go, you know. And that was the switch. That was the thing for me. It basically came out because I was looking for something to stop me, because obviously I can't work, so I'm at home. And I was going mad because I had nothing to do with myself all day. You know, to somebody who works all the time, if you said that you got to sit around all the time, they'd think it was great. And I think it might be a great thing. Like, oh, I'd love to do that. It's like, yeah, but 2 months into it, you're climbing the walls.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, and I think that's why people don't understand that writers have to. I mean, if you're a working writer and you make a living off of it, like Stephen King or Dean Koontz or whatever, I think you still have to have the routine of getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning, sitting down, writing, you know, and then you do press or whatever. And then I had a friend who was a writer and was in the Swedish Academy. Ones who choose the Nobel Prize, and he'd been a working writer for many, many years before he passed away. And he said that, I mean, he got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, he wrote until 12, and the rest of it was research, answering letters, talking to publisher. Sometimes he had to go to Stockholm to do the whole, you know, meeting with the other members and stuff like that. So I mean, he said you have to have a routine and you have to treat it like a real job, because the illusion of being a writer and writing whenever you want, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I do something very similar, because I wake up every day around about like 5:30, 6 o'clock, and I'll sit and I'll start writing, and then I'll have something to eat and a bit of a nap. Because I have to take a lot of medication and it just wipes me out. Yeah. So basically I have to just go and crash for a little bit. And then I'll come back, and then while I'm sort of still a bit fuzzy around the edges, I'll tend to do all my online stuff, like promotion and, you know, sorting out my website and designing graphics and all this other little bits and pieces that don't seem a lot to people who don't know, but they take up a lot of time. And then I'll start writing again after dinner, and I'll do another couple of hours before bedtime. Now it's basically my routine, yeah. And it's great, it's the thing, because if you look at it, it's kind of a very similar to what I used to do in the kitchens. I'd go in the morning, do the morning shift, then I'd go and have a nap in the afternoon, and then back, because it was always split shifts.
Yeah,
okay. And you go back, and then you go back in the afternoon and do through till like 11, 12. And I do a very similar thing with my writing, which works for me, because I think routines are useful in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I tried it the other way when I first started. I'll just do a bit here and there, and I never got anything done, because I was just like, oh, I'll do it a bit. Oh, I'll do it a bit, you know? That's procrastination starts.
Yeah, and I did that too. I was just like, you know what, I'll write this story while I'm inspired to write it, and then, you know, another story will come up and you'll want to write on that one, and then you end up having a bunch of unfinished stories. And then somewhere you have to make the decision, like, this is the story that I'm going to focus on now.
And yeah, I do that.
And finish it. And that's how I finished my debut novel, was doing that. Otherwise, it would have never gotten finished.
Yeah, I do that. I work on one thing at a time. I'll get ideas while I'm doing them, but that's why I've got like 100 notebooks around the flat. Because I'll just, when I get an idea, I'll just scribble it down. And some of these ideas are pretty full-formed. So I'll just scribble it all down, and then if a call comes up for a story in this sort of vein, I'll go, oh, I've got something for that. And then I can just read through it and just go and type it out. Once I've got the idea, because I'm not a plotter. I can't do that. If I start doing that, I will never get anything done, you know, because I'll be going, oh, if I put this bit here and then it just, I'll lose track of things. I'm a complete and total pantser. So I'll just sit down and write until something is done and then go and bugger about with it in the editing. You know, I could go and snip things here and move things about if necessary in the edit. Yeah, it seems to work for me. So.
Well, it works. I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, I'll often write ad lib it or whatever until I get to reach a certain point. Like right now, I'm working on something that has to be done by December. Mm-hmm. And I'm 7 chapters deep and it needs to be 12 chapters. So I know I have 12 chapters to work on because that's the deal that I made. And then I use a program called Scrivener. Excellent program to use. And if anybody's out there and they're doing the National Novel Writing Month, usually at the end of it, you'll usually get an offer to buy it at a certain reduced rate. And that's what I did. And it's helped tremendously because you could do so many. I mean, and this isn't sponsored by Scrivener in any way, but if they do want to sponsor.
I don't use it, so.
If they do want to sponsor, fine.
Yeah.
I'm open.
Yeah, that'd be great. Bring it on.
But I mean, I think it's a great tool because they have kind of like this cork board overview where you put like, these are the chapters. And then you can write down what you think that every chapter is going to be about, but then you can move it around on the corkboard. And then in every chapter, you can do scenes. So this is what is going to happen in every scene. Now I don't do that part because that is way too much, but then you can kind of like, so now I'm in that point is like, I'm 7 chapters deep. I'm not really sure where it's going yet, but I know where I want it to end. So I have to write what's going to happen in every chapter so that I know how we get there.
So, yeah, okay. I get that. I mean, I do similar things, whereas I tend to approach larger things more like episodes than chapters, whereas I'll attack each chapter like a short story to start, a middle, and an end, and then continues on in the next one. I mean, I've taken that idea to the extreme in the novel I've nearly finished. I've only got, like, the epilogue to do. I've taken that to the extreme. It is literally episodes rather than chapters. They're self-contained, but there is a story. Basically like a Netflix series in print. That was kind of what I was... have you read Lovecraft Country by Matt Ruff?
Yes.
Yeah, like that. It's like, yeah, because that's like episodes rather than chapters. Like each one has a title and a plot. But they all go into an overarching thing. I mean, it goes back to like things like what Link Carter did with the Zodiac Legend cycle and stuff like that.
And really, I mean, it goes back to, even if you want to take it as far as going back to like Gulliver's Travels or even...
Yes, of course. Robinson Gulliver's Crusoe. Travels is a great...
Because all like, okay, Robinson Crusoe is on this island for whatever, 40 years or whatever it is. And basically each chapter is about an episode that happened, you know, something that happens to him while he's on the island.
Yeah, that's a great example, actually, because again, that was something that came to mind when I started doing it. I was like, oh, this is a little bit like Gulliver's Travels, you know, and all that. Another one that inspired me quite a bit was The Trail of Cthulhu, August Derleth. Yeah, his Trail of Cthulhu, because that's the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And obviously because of what I write, there was a lot of similar themes in them.
I'm going to bet that you are probably the first ever writer to say that they've been inspired by August Derleth, seeing as most people kind of like vilify him.
I don't get it. I really don't, because, I mean, I understand the purist aspect of it, and I do understand that, but Lovecraft himself would expand things. I mean, he basically incorporated Arthur Machen, Robert Chambers, Ambrose Bierce into his sort of cycle and things. And it was him who brought in Derleth in the first place.
Yeah.
And I think that it wouldn't, I mean, it's just a different take on it. And I can see why the purists hate it, but if, I mean, I preferred us to read them as for what they are.
Yeah.
And they're cracking good pulp horror stories.
I think the problem is that people who are Lovecraft purists, they won't give Derleth the same leeway they give Lovecraft. Because, I mean, to be honest, not everything that Lovecraft ever produced was good. And it's, there's something for everyone. No, I really love Reanimator. I can never remember what it's called, The Tomb or In the Vault.
There is The Tomb and In the Vault.
But it's the one where
the tomb is the one on the submarine.
No, yeah, I'm thinking about the one where he's a gravedigger or mortician, and he builds like cheap coffins.
The cheap coffins, that's in the vault. Yeah, that's in the vault. I love that one.
Yeah, I love those kinds of, but some people don't like them, and I don't really care for the cosmic aspect. I don't like the music of Eric Zahn. I don't like...
I do like the music of Eric Zahn. The problem, I have more of the ones I'm not too keen on are some of the of his early sort of Dunsany pastiches. Mm. Things like Polaris and The High House and The Mist.
White Ship, just maybe?
Yeah, White Ship. They're all. I mean, some of the Dreamland stuff that he did later, like I'm a massive fan of The Cats of Ulthar, and things like that. But the early ones, they're just far too purple and meandering, and it's just they're really hard to get through for me.
Well,
I'm not a fan of Dunsany.
No, so, me neither. No, yeah. But I think also it's because nothing happens in them. They're just like a historical story. Like this is.
Yes.
You know, first this happened.
I mean, some of them are not even that. Some of them are just basically a mood.
Yeah.
which might be great if you're on laudanum or something.
Yeah. But, I was thinking that they're very surreal. And I think when Derleth is really good, he's really good. But then when he's kind of mediocre, he's not that entertaining.
No, some of his stuff, I mean, one of the problems I have with Derleth, but I can see past it because I like the stories, is he tends to just read off shopping lists of mythos stuff. He'll go through all the tomes, he'll go through all the names of all the old ones, and all this, and it's just like you get page after page after page, and he does it like, over and over again, and it's just like, oh, did you have a word count and you couldn't fill it? but stories like The Whippoorwills in the Hills, I love that one. The Strange Dark Brotherhood or whatever the one he did about like meeting Edgar Allan Poe.
One's the one that I was thinking about, the seven deadly Poes show up. It's a
But I love that. I think that's a great one. I mean, that's an underrated classic, that one, for me. It's just such a bonkers concept. And it ties into Shadow Out of Time, doesn't it?
Yeah. I listened to a live read of that from Necronomic... No, yeah. What would be Necronomicon? The Lovecraft Con.
The convention, yeah.
Yeah. And it was H.P. Lovecraft, the podcast, H.P. Podcraft.
Right, yes, yeah.
And they did not like it. They did not care for it at all. But I think also they are part of that group that don't give Derleth the same, you know, they don't treat Derleth the same as they would treat Lovecraft. Because, Derleth is very much like Lovecraft. Is that there's good parts and there are bad parts. But since you're a Lovecraft purist and Derleth came afterwards, you can't afford to give him the same for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is as well, what gets me with that sort of thinking is you've got to remember that if it wasn't for Derleth, we probably wouldn't be reading it because it would all be gone.
Yeah.
He was the one who actually took it after he died and made a publishing house to actually get it in print because he didn't want his friend's work to be lost.
No.
And also, you've got to give him credit because if it wasn't for Derleth, we probably wouldn't have Ramsay Campbell.
Exactly.
And Brian Lumley and W.H. Pugmire.
And Block.
Robert Block. Yeah, because them guys were all basically given a chance by him in the Arkham House. I mean, Campbell... I mean, he'd created his milieu, you know, the Brychester Seven Valley stuff. He created that because of something that Derleth said to him in a correspondence, because he'd written his first stories in Arkham and all the rest of it. But obviously he's Liverpudlian and he's never been to Massachusetts. So Derleth said to him, look, great stories, but they're not coming across authentic because you don't know what you're talking about. So why don't you go and create your own thing? And he did, and it's some of the best mythos stuff you'll read.
And I mean, I think that's interesting because, I mean, obviously Derleth sets a lot of his stuff in Wisconsin.
Yes.
That's where he came
from. So does Block. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's interesting. So is that, I mean, if you look at your inspiration for your own writing, is it mainly the mythos cycle? I mean, you mentioned Pugmire, and to be fair, a lot of people who read Lovecraft and enjoy Lovecraft but aren't deeply embedded or involved in Lovecraft and his world, so people will have heard of Derleth. People will have heard of Block. Campbell, maybe. Lumley, maybe, but basically from his own, what is it? His
zombie necroscope stuff.
Yeah, necroscope stuff.
Yeah.
But they will not have heard of Pugmire. And Pugmire is, he was a big deal.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I love his stuff because there's also like, it's very poetic because he was also a massive fan of Oscar Wilde. So basically his stuff is like a mashup of Lovecraft and Wilde. And it's just, some of it is just beautiful and disturbing at the same time, which is right up my alley. I mean, I love that.
but is that where is your inspiration mainly those guys, or are you talking, because you and I have talked about Kernan. Catherine Kernan. And I mean, we haven't mentioned Laird Barron. But is that somebody?
I'm a big fan of Laird Barron as well. His stuff is some of the most brutal stuff you will get. But it's hard to explain Barron to people who are not really sort of au fait with it. But especially weird fiction in general. Yeah. But I love his old leech stuff, his old one. Some of that is just delightfully creepy. But I mean, he's from Alaska, isn't he?
Yeah.
And you get that sort of bleakness with his stuff that you would expect from somewhere that's basically frozen all the time. I mean, I read a lot. And yeah, Caitlin Arkinan is one of my favorites, one of my personal favorites. Because again, her stuff is just, whoa. It's like if you read one of her first novels, Threshold, starts off with this bit in a tunnel, in a water treatment plant, and something happens, but you don't know what, and then it jumps to something else, and it's a great hook because you're kind of like, did that just happen? Did that really happen? What is going on? But she expanded on an aspect of the Lovecraft and mythos stuff that I'm personally a big favorite of, which is ghouls. Like Pickman and all that. And she came up with the children of the cuckoo, basically changelings, where there was the society of ghouls that would go and swap ghoul children with human babies. And then the human babies were raised by the ghouls and they were kind of like soldiers. It's just brilliant. I mean, Daughter of Hounds.
There's a painting like that in Pickman's model, isn't there?
Yes, yeah. And she basically extrapolated that whole idea just from that painting thing. I just thought, it was brilliant. I mean, a lot of my influence comes from that, but also further back, I'm a massive fan of Arthur Machen. Mm-hmm. I love Machen stuff. I mean, here's another one, an episodic novel, The Three Imposters, is just genius. I mean, some of the pieces in that have been published as standalone short stories. Wow. Things like the novel of the Black Seal and things like that. I mean, that's in Chaosium's Nyarlathotep cycle.
Yeah. I have that one.
No, it's not. It's the Haster cycle, isn't it? The
Haster cycle. Yeah, I don't have that one.
I've got them all. yeah, and I love his stuff, and The Great God Pan as well. I read that as a kid, and I was just like, whoa, that's brilliant. Another one, big one for me was Algernon Blackwood. His stuff like The Willows and The Wendigo.
Yeah, Wendigo.
Stuff like that. Yeah.
That's awesome, yeah. So I mean
that's where Derleth got his idea for Ithaca from, wasn't it?
Okay.
His old one, Ithaca. Back to Derleth, actually. It's funny that the novella I've got coming out on the 11th is I actually use one of Derleth's creations, which is Cthugha, you know, the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I use that. My other big major influence was The King in Yellow. Mm. I've written several King in Yellow stories. So I love that. Robert W. Chambers. That's some of the creepiest stuff I've ever, and it's so decadent. And it's just great. I mean, you can smell the absinthe when you're reading it, you know? But aside from that, I mean, I'm also inspired by writers in completely different genres. I'm a big fan of P.G. Woodhouse.
Mm.
So you'll see that in a lot of my stories, that I'll get this sort of foppish Britishness in there. I mean, there's a lot of British humour in what I write. A lot of that comes from things like Woodhouse and Agatha Christie as well. I'm a big fan of that. And so I'll put bits of that in. Some of the old detective fiction I love, like Conan Doyle and all that kind of business. But big fan of Christie, again, because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents growing up, and they were members of the Reader's Digest.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know what I mean? So they had, like, all of them. So on then long, like, winter months when school was out and it was tipping it down with rain outside, I basically read through all of them.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's interesting because I'm the same way. I mean, I'll have one. I think I think you can split inspiration into two parts. One, inspiration of what it is you write, and the second inspiration is how you write. And those two don't have to correlate. And I think that's where you find your own voice. The mix between it. Because I'm heavily influenced in the language wise of Woodhouse, Graham Greene, the American author Garrison Keillor. I don't know if you know who that is.
No, I don't know. No.
He's very American, very Midwestern. Basically, his stories, they're very much like P.G. Woodhouse, just set in the American Midwest.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
I'd probably enjoy that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you would. And then you come from the other end, which is what you write about. And I mean, I write a lot of, you know, noir and fantasy and science fiction. And to blend those two aspects is I think it's fun. Because it's like, well, what would Graham Greene's science fiction sound like? Well, it sounds kind of like this, probably.
Yeah, well, my another novella of mine, which is coming out in February, came from a daft idea. A lot of them come from these daft ideas. I had this daft idea of what if Day of the Triffids was written by H.P. Lovecraft and then turned into a Carry-On film. And that's where Miracle Growth came from. So it is basically like Carry-On, Lovecraft does the Triffids. It's full of absurd British humour and double entendre and just this ridiculous Python-esque almost, you know, these ridiculous characters. But yeah, I'm quite pleased with that one.
Isn't that Douglas Adams though, in a lot of ways?
Basically, sci-fi meets things like Monty Python and things like that.
I think he wrote for Monty Python for a while. I think he was part
I'm not
of that
sure.
Group.
He wrote for Doctor Who. I know that.
Well, who didn't write for Doctor Who? I'm surprised
He was the script editor. He was actually their script editor for a while during the Tom Baker era. And he wrote several scripts, but he was actually like the season script editor. So yeah, he was quite like, he was basically number two in the production team at the time.
Because he did write something with Terry Jones, right? The Starship Titanic.
Yes.
I don't
think he ever did Python, because that was written by them. They didn't
It might have been something else.
I don't know. You might be right. Yeah. I just don't remember hearing that. But I know he worked with various members of the Python
team. It could be that.
I mean, he did something with Cleese as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of... I like that, there's a British author named Tom Holt, and then there's Robert Rankin. Yes.
I love Robert Rankin.
Yeah.
Hollow Chocolate Bunnies of the Apocalypse. Now that is a brilliant book.
Yeah, and we talked to Derek Power, the Irish writer. We talked at length about Robert Rankin and Tom Holt, two of his favorite authors as well. You kind of have to look at it, because Robert Rankin can be, I mean, it's delightfully absurd, but then it can be very, very sexual, almost unnecessarily so.
Yeah, them bits, I don't know, them bits don't really work for me as well as his biting satire. I love the fact that it's so satirical, but in such an abstract way that it doesn't come across as preachy in any kind of... I mean, satire for me, it works if it doesn't come across as beating the drum, if you know what I mean.
And I think, I mean, Robert Rankin in many ways is like, it's Terry Pratchett if Terry Pratchett did not have any rules.
Yes. Well, I was just about to say, very similar to Pratchett, but he's basically the adult Pratchett, isn't he?
Yeah, and they were friends. Pratchett introduced Rankin to his wife. I mean, that's how Rankin met his wife, was through Pratchett. Mm. So, anyway, let's talk about your upcoming work.
Indeed.
How long have you been? Did you write before you got published, and how long from the first time you got published to getting a solo work published?
I started writing at sort of January 2019 properly, but I'd completely forgotten what I was doing, and I was writing a novel, and I still need to go back and rewrite massive parts of that, because the beginning is a mess, but by the end of it, I was getting back into it, and I thought, right, I'm going to give some short stories a go, and I started writing them, and then going back and rewriting them, doing another one, and then going back and rewriting another one. And I got to the point in sort of like September, I think it was, when I thought, right, these are at a standard that I can at least start punting them about a bit. And it was June. And my first acceptance was in September. So it took a while, but to begin with, I was doing what a lot of authors do straight away and stop punting them to all the big magazines.
Mm.
And you must know yourself that, to get in one of them, you need all the sort of stars to align to do that, because the volume of submissions that they must get must be astronomical.
Well, I sent the thing that I sent in was two Tor books.
Nice, yeah.
My first manuscript.
Yeah, the first thing I did, the first story I sent off, I submitted to Vastarian, you know, the Thomas Ligotti magazine. Yeah. It was just like, they're thinking that, it's got a chance, and now it hasn't.
Especially when
you look at the issue that came out to the one I think, and it was all names. It was all like Jonathan Mabry and Caitlin Kiernan, and it's all names. And I was just like, that explains a lot. But then I discovered the Horror Tree, and I got all these submissions like for upcoming anthologies. And so I started sending some stuff out for that. And I sent, the first story I wrote specifically for a call was the one I wrote for the anthology Death and Butterflies, which was Suicide House, Natalie Brown's publishing house. And I sent that, and that got accepted at the end of September. And then I had a few more after that. And then it wasn't that long since I had my first larger thing. I think that was February that got accepted. Because I remember I wrote it over Christmas, and I subbed it to Black Hair Press. But it was one of those that it's part of a series called Underground. So there was a lot, and the submission window was like still open for like another 8 months or something. So that's coming out in February. So that was actually accepted a long time ago. And in the other time, I've written loads more like novellas and things. But I mean, for a lot of these submissions for longer pieces, you expect to wait for about at least 6 months.
Yeah.
In my experience, anyway, the exception to that rule that I found was my first novella that's coming out, because that was a couple of months ago, at least, maybe a little bit longer. I forget the actual date. Hang on, I'll have a look. I forget the actual date, but I subbed that Manison Press, who I had a short story with in there. Anthology Little Boy Lost, which also had people like Piers Anthony in it. Mm-hmm. That was a great one for me, because Burning Reflection was accepted on the 15th of August.
Okay.
And that's coming out on the 11th of November, but that was only out for submission for about, because I'd started writing it for one of Erie River's monthly, you know, they do the monthly contest. Yeah. And that month's was Mirrors. And I started writing this, and it just, yeah. Like David Green is always quite, you know, always mocks me relentlessly for. If I start writing a drabble, it'll turn into a novella. That basically happened. It was supposed to be a 5,000 word short story. Yeah. It turned into a novella. And luckily Manison just put up that they were doing the Manison mini books. Then they had a short submission window, and they'd have announced it on their thing before actually opening the window. So literally on the day it opened, I was hovering above the send button waiting for the announcement. And as soon as it went up, it was like click.
I've got one of those coming up. I'm waiting. November 1st is the opening. So I'm the same way. I have to finish writing the query letter, or tweaking the query letter so it fits this particular publisher. And I don't think that David Green shouldn't, I mean, because he mocks me as well.
He mocks everybody.
The 2113, I went over the count too.
I did as well. surprise, I did.
The latest project that we're doing, I saw that he also went over the count. So,
yes, he has.
So
yes.
You can shut up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know he's listening. He'll be listening to this. So,
yeah, I know. Hello, David.
So tell us, what is Burning Reflections all about?
Burning Reflection, without giving too much away, is about a guy who basically his uncle passes away, and he's the last surviving relative. He's a doctor in Truro. And he goes back to his family home, which is out on Bodmin Moor in Cornwall. And there's, as part of the stipulation, he gets a warning in the form of a diary from his uncle. And basically, his uncle had a pathological fear of mirrors, spectrophobia. And obviously, he thinks it's all nonsense. You know, as you would, quite frankly, and basically every shiny surface in the place is covered by like some kind of shroud, or forks and spoons are left to tarnish so there's no reflection. He goes in there, wants to change everything. Weird stuff starts happening. And without giving too much away, people, you know, all hell breaks loose, as is quite often happens in the case of my stories. Lots of death, lots of destruction. Yeah. And that's pretty much the gist of it without giving too much away. I mean, there's aspects of not just like the reflective aspect, but there's a lot of occult in it, because it is basically within the Cthulhu mythos. But there's also a lot of numerology in there, I don't want to give it away.
Oh, no, that's fine. I mean, numerology is, I think numerology is an aspect in horror fiction that is very rarely explored. I mean, I think that's why the number 23... the movie with Jim Carrey was actually more, I mean, like a sleeper hit. I don't think anybody expected it to be.
Yeah. Now, you see, I enjoyed that, which is unusual, because I'm not a fan of Jim Carrey.
Me neither, I did enjoy that.
His serious acting, I thought he was actually quite good at it. It's his goofy off the wall stuff. It just drives me up the wall. I hate
Pet Detective.
I
hate Dumb and Dumber.
Me too. And The Mask. Terrible. Sorry, any Jim Carrey fans out there, but I'm just not.
No.
Like, the other one is Jack Black for me. He does my head in as well.
I don't really know what to say about Jack Black. I mean, I liked him in High Fidelity, but on the other hand, I liked High Fidelity because of what it was about. But I mean, I can't say that he was the best part of High Fidelity.
No. I mean, I think in that he kind of works, because he's not right in your face all the time.
No.
It's the other stuff where he just gurns his way through 2 hours of film, makes stupid voices, and just acts like a bit of a pillock. I just can't get into it.
his best movie must be The Jackal, where he gets his arm shot off by the Jackal.
I haven't seen it.
The remake with, I think, Richard Gere that came out.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
It was like, he only had like...
I've seen the original, but I haven't seen the remake.
No, he just has a small part. I think it's like one of his first roles. And he's like, he's supposed to hold something so that the Jackal can fire this gun, and he blows his arm off. That's about what you can take.
Comedy gore, you've got to love it. That's another thing I have in a lot of my stories, is comedy deaths.
Yeah.
But that comes from, aside from literature, my big inspirations in film are things like old Doctor Who, Carry On films, and Hammer Horror. And you get a lot of those kind of like absurd deaths in Hammer Horror films, you know.
I think
what a great one for that was the original Omen.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all comedy deaths if you think about it. You've got the spire falling off and killing the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton, off the top of the church. You've got the sheet of glass flying across this market in Egypt or wherever it is.
And I think, what is it? Is it Hot Fuzz with Simon Pegg?
That was actually the other bigger inspiration in Miracle Growth, Hot Fuzz. Some of the main characters were inspired by Hot Fuzz, because it's that very same sort of thing. It's a small, sleepy little British town that suddenly something very like big is happening. So you've got these small town coppers trying to deal with something in a ridiculous kind of way, you know.
So, why don't you talk about Miracle Growth then, as we anyway are in since you have two books coming out in short succession. Yes.
Yeah, that one is coming out in Black Hair Press in the beginning of February. It's actually up on Amazon to pre-order, as is Burning Reflection. In fact, I don't know if it's the same everywhere, but you can actually buy the paperback now for some unknown reason on Amazon. Because, you know, since the pandemic, their scheduling and things like that has just gone completely up the chute.
I think it depends on what distributor you go through, because I think if you don't set the pre-order date correctly, it'll just launch it. I think it depends on if you're using.
Well, like, I think the paperback being launched prematurely in the UK, I think that was actually intentional by the publisher, because then we could start getting the reviews up, because I've had a few ARC reader, I've had a few advanced copy readers. I think it's a good idea, actually, to be honest. And then you've got the official launch date, which is when, if we're honest about things, especially for something shorter like a novella, most people are going to be buying it in a Kindle these days. Mm. I mean, that's just the way it is. This is the way books have gone, isn't it? It's a lot more electronic now, because it works for commuters and the list to have a device rather than a book in their pocket.
Yeah. But not every place.
So I think that's quite smart.
I mean, because Amazon here in Sweden just launched yesterday.
Yeah.
And Swedes don't have Kindles unless they've been to England or they've been to, you know, somewhere that actually sells them.
Right.
So Swedes aren't that used to electronic. There are a couple of e-readers that are distributed by actual like Swedish booksellers.
Right.
But they don't, it's not very common here. People still actually read books. But I saw that your book was not available on Swedish Amazon yet. But I'm thinking since they just launched yesterday, I think they're just adding stuff. Because only two of my books were available.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it'll take time for everything to get on there. Yeah. I know it's available everywhere else because I've checked. Yeah. I've been on the .com and Canada and Australia, and it's like, it's there.
We need to check Barnes & Noble and Book Depository and stuff like that.
No, I don't, but I probably should. I mean, over here, we don't really have that over here.
No.
We have Waterstones, and that's pretty much it.
Well, Book Depository is a British. I buy.
Oh, it is, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting confused. There's so many distributors these days that I get really confused with them. But I know Manison with Burning Reflection have done a really good job of getting it on all of these different platforms, because they got one of the book to read link things.
Yeah.
And it comes up with all these different buttons to press. So you got like Kobo and Apple and Amazon and about another six of them that I don't even know what they are that you people can get the ebook from. So that's great.
Yeah, it depends on what distributor you use. I mean, if you use Ingram Spark or if you use Draft to Digital, there are different places. Smashwords, I think there's a...
Smashwords is something that Manison use a lot. Yeah. I mean, they tend to do like a Smashwords edition and things like that. They use that a lot. I've actually got a Smashwords profile with my two releases that I've had with Manison on it. I should look at that more, because I don't know if anything else of mine is on there. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think what you do is that the company, the publisher, sends the book proof and everything to, like, say, Draft to Digital, and then that Draft to Digital just distributes it. Then you don't have to do anything, and then they take like 10% of the every sale, which is a smooth way, because then they make sure that it gets on Amazon, Barnes and Noble,
right,
Swedish sites, German sites, you know, all the different, where, you know, and not only Amazon, I mean, like local German booksellers and stuff like that.
That's great. I mean, I'm not very good at that side of it. I'm good at the promotion side of it. I'm very good at going, "Ooh, look at me," like with all my internet stuff. I'm quite good at that, but I'm not very good at the admin side of things. This is why I'm really, really like blessed to have got with some really good publishers.
Yeah.
I mean, because Manison have been great. The stuff I've had like with people like Erie River has been absolutely superb. Black Hair Press are great. You know, the really good publishers So I've been quite lucky in that respect. Mm. I've been a couple that have not been so hot on anything, but it's just what happens, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
But
we'll go back to the book.
Indeed. Which one?
Well, the one we were talking about before you
started waffling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one in February.
Yes, that one is. Basically, it's about the annual fruit and vegetable show at a parish church. And it's a stiff competition, you know. Mm-hmm. And some people would stoop to anything to get ahead in the vegetable growing competition. So there's this hooky compost going about, which is supposed to work miracles. And, yeah. Long story short, all hell breaks loose.
As it does. You know,
as it always does. And then, yeah, and it's down to a ragtag assortment of locals. Like there's a burly policeman and his elderly mother, and who was a member of the Women's Institute, and a farmer and some just random characters. Have to try and fight this menace. And yeah, and again, like I say, it's kind of like Lovecraft meets Day of the Triffids meets Hot Fuzz meets a Carry On film. Yeah, so it's lots of British humour in it, and also lots of gore as well. So yeah.
Rhino would be proud.
Yes.
The completely different type of gore. You could hire him as your promotional tool.
Yeah, you should.
I don't know if you. I know you haven't watched Impact for a while, but they did a special a couple of months back where it was a throwback episode, so it was like was supposed to be in the I think early 90s, late 80s. So they all had like they didn't have the wrestlers didn't have their normal names. They were like Pizza Delivery Gimmicks. Jones.
Ah, yeah.
And Rhino was
Duke the Dumpster Drosy.
Yeah. So and Rhino was supposed to play. He played a character called like the Butcher, and he only did a promo that he was coming to their territory. And he's like,
one of the vignettes that they used to do.
So he's got like this apron on. And then he's covered in blood and he's holding a hatchet. And he's just like, I'm coming, chop, chop.
Oh, I'm watching that. I'm going to find that.
It's hilarious. And I think they don't get enough credit for what they're doing right now.
Oh, that's genius. I mean, that is genius. Let's face it. Yeah. I mean, I love that concept. Because I love watching all the old stuff, all the old like the documentaries about all the old stuff on the network and that. All these hokey characters they used to have.
Yeah.
Like there was one Mantar who was basically a bloke in a bull costume.
Yeah. Yeah.
The absolute classic was the Shockmaster.
Yeah, the one who fell.
fell through the wall.
And he had like this
And his stormtrooper helmet fell off.
And then the stormtrooper helmet. He had a stormtrooper helmet that was, what, like sparkly. Silver, or something.
It was sparkly. It was sparkly. And big sequins.
Never got that. Never understood.
Oh, it was hilarious.
Or the Yeti, or Friar. Oh, yeah. Well, there was a guy that was dressed as a monk, right?
Yeah, that was, and then when he moved to the WWF, he was Bastion Booger.
Yeah.
another stupid character.
Yeah.
Like, another classic was the Repo Man, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did. I was a little bit afraid of the Repo Man.
Yeah, I thought he was funny. I thought he was great, personally.
It was so, I understood that was supposed to be like some kind of rib. Because that was one of the guys from Demolition.
Yes, it was. It was Smash. Yeah, Barry Darso.
And I understood that he was in financial trouble and he was like chased by the IRS. Yeah. And this was like Vince McMahon's rib. that he had to play there. I guess he hates. He doesn't like to mention it. So if people talk to him, you're not supposed to ask him about the rebrand, just like you're not supposed to ask the Undertaker about the American Badass gimmick, because apparently he hated that gimmick.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Really upset. Yeah. And then there are people, well, you and I would call them marks, because we know the lingo.
Yeah, the lingo, yeah.
But that want to see the American Badass return.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen.
It's never going to happen. No, because I've heard that he doesn't like it. He's quite happy to talk about Mean Mark.
Yeah.
But that was before The Undertaker. But and he invested so much of his own stuff into the character. And he was one of them guys who kept kayfabe.
Yeah.
So whenever he was out of the business, he was dressed all in black. And he didn't talk to people. I mean, he protected his business, didn't he? Mm.
Well, there's a wrestler like that now, Rosemary, who wrestles for Impact Wrestling, who is supposed to be like an undead character, comes from the undead realm. We used to be managed by, and I think you'll know him, Father James Mitchell. He was in ECW.
He was an ECW guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's still around.
He worked a lot with Raven back in the day.
He's still around.
He blew all the skin off his fingers. He was drunk backstage with Raven and the Sandman. And one of his gimmicks was he had a flash gun and he would shoot fireballs. And he was packing in the flash paper. And Raven was going, oh, put some more in. So the idiot did. And he ended up blowing off his fingers. And he was so drunk that he stayed in character. So when the ambulance man came, and he came up, he was talking to Mikey Whipwreck, like, Mikey, look at the blood. He was out of his tree.
Yeah, well, we can't get not. We'll have to do our own like wrestling podcast.
Yeah, we should.
Well, Tim, our time is winding down for this time. So, where can people find you on the old internet? Now, this is not a video, so don't use your.
I've not got them. No, you don't bother writing them. That's the same reason I haven't bothered doing my eyeliner. I think the easiest way to do it, way of getting it, doing it, is of just say my website, because that's got links to my YouTube, Goodreads, Amazon, my Facebook. It's all on there. It's all on my website. So it's easier if I just say that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is timmendyswriter.wordpress.com.
Simple. Yep.
Yeah, simple and effective. Yeah, Tim Mendy's writer. It's all one word, all lowercase. .wordpress.com. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on and plugging your new book.
My pleasure,
and
I mean, sir.
We talked about so many other things, like always when you and I.
I know. Yeah, this is what happens when we talk, isn't it? Just because.
And people can find you on the Guild here because you host the Guild After Hours. And a new one is going to drop soon. I mean, it's up on the YouTube right now, right?
Yep. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's up on YouTube now. Basically, that one had some edits. So basically, I need to get the edited version of the audio over to you. That's not a problem. I've just not got round to doing it yet. I've been really busy this week because I've got a deadline looming. I've been really, really sort of swamped by deadlines this week. Mm-hmm. I've got two or three things going and I've got the edits in and just one of them weeks, you know how it goes.
I have
a couple of weeks where there's nothing really happening and then everything happens at once.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tim.
My pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Welcome back. First of all, I'd like to apologize. This always happens when Tim and I get together. We go off on so many different tangents. The whole Lovecraftiana bit where he mentioned a bunch of different authors that you might not have heard of, some of you have, and then also that we go into a whole tangent about wrestling. You can skip those parts if you like, but anyway, it's kind of interesting because it delves into to our minds of how we think and what we relate to and stuff like that. I would love to thank you for listening. I'd like to thank you for tuning in. Please share this podcast, rate, review, whatever, anywhere you can do that. I'd like to thank Tim Mendes for coming on and being a special guest. And also I'd like to thank John Holtman for providing the music today. We'll be back next time with another guest. Stay safe out there. Bye.